F1, F2, F off, F F F off, F off, 2 F off, F 2 F off, back to Russia, to Russia, back to Russia. F off, back to Russia.
Tuned into Pandemonium, a public affairs program from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium. An apocalypse is an event on a grand scale, a catastrophe that affects our lives indelibly. It is also a story that, judging from the sheer volume of them that we tell, alone and together, has a definite ending, the details of which we are rather concerned with. What is it about the current day that so often casts our focus onto apocalypse and the events that follow it? Is there a background noise of sublime terror, a raging storm, or news of permanent collapse pervading our lives, driving political conflict, justifying ever greater engineering of social order? And is this disaster specific to us, or has it always been present throughout the ages? In first seeking the center of the apocalypse, I sat down with Ben Knight, a Berlin-based filmmaker, and asked him about the movie he just made.
Okay, so it is called We're All Going to Die, and it is about people who are preparing in one way or another for catastrophe. And it kind of moves through different types of preparation. So it begins with your standard prepper type person who would be like hoarding food and maybe learning new skills and figuring out how to, you know, use radios again rather than cell phones, and you know, although yeah, just preppers, and then sort of talking about how they their kind of disappointment with the way everyone else is just carrying on their day, and they have to think about all these terrible things that are going to happen. So that's the kind of the beginning of it. Anyway, so I met a couple of preppers, and then it kind of moves into a more climate change, climate grief is a big thing now amongst a lot of people, and it has been for quite a while. And I met a couple of people in the States who went through a profound grief 20 years ago because they felt like this economic and social system was totally unsustainable. And so there was this, he's called Guy McPherson. He went and 20 years ago, he felt like, you know, this isn't going to work. No. And he went and lived on a homestead in New Mexico. He was a tenured professor, and he gave up his job and went and lived on a homestead in New Mexico and learned how to make cheese. And then he realized that there was another thing that meant that even if somehow humans prevented the burning of fossil fuels overheating the earth, because of what he calls the aerosol dimming effect, the pollution would actually shields us from the worst heat of the sun. So even if we reduced pollution, we would be fried too. So he then realized that we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't, and decided that he couldn't be bothered to live on a homestead anymore, and now he just lives in a normal house and gives interviews and does podcasts and things like that. And he calls himself an educator. I mean, he's like an odd fellow, because he kind of, what was interesting about him for me was because he went through this period of profound despair and grief, and what he thought was that the futility of trying to continue, and then he came out of the other side of it and said, well, look, you know, we're all going to die, so there's nothing anyone else could do about it, so I might as well just live the best life I can the way I want to live and not worry about anything. And that's what he does now. Do I feel that daily life has given over to chaos? No, I feel like what is surprising about the current situation is that everyone is carrying on as normal and basically shutting out the chaos as much as they can and finding ways to distract each other. I mean, there's always like an initial shock moment, as it happened when, especially if you live in Europe, when Russia just invaded Ukraine, for example. But then after a few days, and you know, we have like hundreds of thousands of refugees, you started noticing that people were posting their Wordle scores on Twitter again, which they had been doing, you know, quite regularly up until that moment. And then there was about a week where people stopped doing it, and then they kind of put them back. So I think there's a natural human tendency to avoid chaos at all costs. If people get used to things, don't they? It's surprising how quickly people get used to disaster scenarios and learn to cope. I mean, I was reading, I mean, just to get back to the same example again, but I was reading reports now of people in Kiev and how, you know, they want to open the schools again in Kiev tomorrow. They want to do online schooling again. Which is like crazy when you think about, you know, that the Russian army is 20, 25 kilometers away from the city center still. Well, first thing was that someone told me that they were going to go to Mexico anyway. And I thought, oh, that would be cool to go to Mexico. And then I thought, and then I remembered that in Mexico, it's the site of the center of the Chicxulub crater, which is the crater that was caused by the asteroid that killed all the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. And I kind of thought it would be, you know, what better place to sort of conclude the film, but at the site of a catastrophe that almost wiped out all life on Earth. And one of the five great big mass extinction events that have happened, the last one that has happened throughout in our history. And so I had this sort of vision of filming at this, because I knew there was a little monument there. There's a little memorial to the dinosaurs in this town, and it's a town on the northern coast of Yucatan, in the Yucatan Peninsula, a sort of coastal town. But the crater itself is 100 miles across, so you obviously can't see it, and it is also about a kilometer underground. And they only really found out that it was there in the 1980s. And I just thought I'd, but then when they did find it, the little town, and it's a kind of like there's nothing really in the town. It's like a beach resort, but not a particularly fancy one. There are no big hotels there, but they do have a little monument to the dinosaurs, which I thought was quite poignant. So I wanted to film there, and so I did a little thing where I stood next to the monument and spoke to the camera about my feelings about why I wanted to film a scene there, and why, you know, why I saw that point as a kind of the starting point for the film, even though it was right at the end of filming. So that was one reason. Oh, the other thing was that there's a lot of Mayan people still around there, and people often think of the Mayan civilization as a civilization that collapsed. So I was quite interested in that too, so I interviewed a few Mayan people. I mean, most of the people in that region are still have Mayan heritage, so that was pretty interesting. And rather than a cycle, I would think of it as concentric circles, that we're always kind of living in a space that has been created by a past disaster, that we are never really the destruction of all the dinosaurs was the event that made our evolution possible. You know, I mean, it's getting a bit, like, obviously a bit esoteric now, but the idea is that we're always living in the aftermath of another disaster, and that disaster is what made our lives even possible. So I wanted kind of the end of the film, I want people to kind of make peace with the idea of apocalypse, make peace with the idea of collapse and destruction, because after all, our own lives depend on someone else's apocalypse and other creatures' extinction, you know. And so I kind of like I see it as sort of, yeah, like we're always in a way our whole we're always inside the crater of an asteroid that crushed the people that came before us, or the dinosaurs that came before us. A lot of people feel a lot of anxiety at the moment, and especially now because of the war, but also because of a lot of people feel a lot of anxiety about climate change, and a lot of people feel general anxiety about, you know, pandemics. People just worry about the future. It's part of our nature to worry about the future, and people want to feel safe, and none of us really are ever safe, and something like the threat of nuclear war kind of really brings that home, you know. I meet an Indian author who's written quite a lot about climate change called Amitav Ghosh, and then he kind of says, well, what's interesting for me about all this is that it's not like I don't worry about the future either, because for people from my my part of the world, he comes from Bangladesh and India, and people from the colonized parts of the world, they've already been through their own destructive apocalypse, and now they're still alive, you know, and they still survive and they still thrive in many ways. And he says that what he sees is basically this anxiety about the future is a kind of is just like our part of the world, the Western part of the world, realizing that it is losing its power. You know, like apparently in grief, like when psychologists talk about grief, there's a thing where if you've got a parent or a grandparent who is dying, and you know that they're going to die, people start to grieve in advance, you know, or especially if they have dementia, you can see them, like, their faculties shutting down one by one, and people who are watching their loved ones die like that, they go through this kind of pre-grief. And there are these therapists and psychoanalysts and psychologists who say that this is what a lot of people are feeling now about the earth itself, or about the society itself. They're feeling this kind of, they're going through this kind of pre-grief for something that is dying. But yeah, there's a nostalgia, there's a loss. We've lost our innocence, and in a weird way, they kind of want the apocalypse to happen so that we regain that innocence. You know, it's kind of it's a very Christian thing, isn't it? It's like we gave up paradise, so now we have to somehow get back to it through a major disaster, and that would like there would be like a purge. It would be like Noah's flood, and then we would get back to our lost innocence. I think a lot of people would say that but probably that's not how it'll pan out, because as you say, we will have certain technologies that we could probably still use for a while anyway. I mean, yeah, depends how long your generator's going to run. I mean, a lot of the preppers that I know are actually, even though they don't believe in climate change, or the ones that I met didn't, they actually hate the Green Party and the Green movement in general. They actually are quite ecologically better prepared than most people, because they have invested in solar panels. Because they do think that the power grid is not sustainable, so they have invested in having in like local solar panels, which is and he yeah this one guy I know in I'm thinking of this guy I know in Cologne who who, yeah, he's extremely skeptical of the climate movement, but he does have he is what do you call it, autonomous from the power grid. I think it would be like the idea that hope is treacherous. I think a lot of these people, a lot of these people, look at the way that normal people, I'd say normal people, but everyone is feels like that we have to, the basically we everyone is like hoping that, you know, like Putin doesn't launch his nuclear weapons, or hoping that we prevent the worst excesses of climate change, or hoping that that you know, society won't collapse and that we'll find some way, we'll keep it together in one way or another. And they see this hope as a delusional thing. And he said, and one guy, Guy McPherson, in fact, he said, I said to him, but surely because he wrote in one of his books, he wrote like, we should give up hope, like hope is this treacherous thing. And I said, but surely the opposite of hope is despair, you know, surely the, and he goes, no, he was like, he like, if he would have slapped his thigh if he could have done, but he was like, no, it's not the, why are you saying that, you know, that's not the tr that, that's not true at all. And then I said, okay, so what is the opposite of hope? And he said, I say the opposite of hope is taking action, is a sort of taking responsibility for your life, or trying to change something. If you really, really do worry about these things, if you are extremely anxious about the future, then hope isn't going to help you. What's going to help you is figuring out how you are going to deal with it and facing it. And I suppose that's what stuck with me, was this sort of this, and that can be practical. It can be like, you know, do what a prepper does and find a bunker in the forest and put us fill it with food, or it can be, you know, joining a climate protest or something. It can be like whatever you do. It can, or it can just be facing up to this, your general anxiety, and figuring out, okay, or because we are all going to die. So what are you going to do with the time you have left? You know, what is valuable to you? And I think that that is sort of the profound thing, is that, you know, we should like this idea that. Yeah, this idea that, that it will all be okay in the end, is a treacherous idea, and in fact, it should be okay now. And all you can really control is this is how you cope with your life. What we're facing is, everybody goes, oh, we're all going to die. Yeah. But then we are all going to die. Like that's the one immutable fact of human existence, is that is that it will end, you know? And fully realizing that is, I think, as I think it's an Achilles in Homer. Doesn't he say everything is more beautiful because we're doomed, and the gods envy us for our mortality, you know, like he say something like that.
For
So
sure.
I think the idea of it is that, you know, we can everything is more beautiful because we're all going to die, you know, because of our mortality, and the gods envy us, the gods, the immortal gods envy us because of that. So I guess it's so what I'm saying is that this sort of fear of the apocalypse is actually just a, is just a facing up to the sort of the human condition, in a very normal way, because, you know, yeah.
A man who has made a more specific, a metaphysical study of apocalypse, through how life should be lived at all times and in all places, is Orthodox rabbinical figure Chad Whitaker of Pittsburgh. I put him to the question in a dark cavern.
People are constantly bringing some sort of post-apocalyptic scenario to bear to, as like an exercise in like some sort of existential threat. And, okay. And perhaps the closer we get to feeling that there's some sort of accelerando in our lifetimes, and it was wars in the past, and now obviously what we're looking at is...
Yeah, more wars, even like heightened. It is a crescendo. Maybe, but here's the thing. All right, so fundamentally, I don't know, right? Like, fundamentally, I don't know. Right. Like, logically, I can picture some scenarios. It's like, I can imagine an existential threat materializing. Like, I can imagine more easily now than last month, right? Like, a nuclear holocaust materializing, right? Or I can imagine an existential threat not materializing and universal paperclips and, like, you know, humanity expanding out into the galaxy or whatever, right? Like, you know, I can imagine Isaac Asimov, last story, sort of like cyclic, like, you know, the boom and bust and the, like, the on universal scales and, like, all of this, right? Like, anything logically imaginable is imaginable, okay? And God's outside of all of it, and God's doing whatever he wants, and there's these fundamental patterns of ordering, of hierarchy, of structure, you know, of structures of beauty, of these abstractions, of these hierarchical structures, like those are kind of circling back around to like this little apocalypse. Like, I really only need to care about what's in front of me. What's, like, what's in my sphere of influence, you know? Well, how about everything else? It's like, well, I don't know. I'm not everything else. Right. Like, I'm me, right. You know? Like, here's what I have to deal with right in front of me.
In terms of that existential threat, though, I think we're always presented with some extraordinarily grim, dark, bleak, like The Road, or Nathan was talking about The Stand earlier.
Yeah, right.
And I guess just like, what do we do in the face of that? What do we do, you know, rationally with a study of history, with a study of, you know, you have this theological framework.
But man, we had apocalypse in the last century. Like, look at Russia last century, you know? Like, look at the utter upheaval of civilization and, like, you know, the Communist Revolution and Stalin and the Gulag and, like, you know, which is like reverberating through to our present day, right? Like this, like these tumultuous, or the, like the Polish Jew, right? Like the, like Holocaust, like they're, like we witnessed in the 20th century, you know, almost as much apocalypse as one could want, let's say, you know, short of an existential crisis, short of an, you know, an existential threat materializing. It's like these were, and then, but then what do individual people do in these, right? Like, there's a book called Father Arseny, there's a biography of this priest named Father Arseny, you know, who was an amazing saint in the Gulag and like kept the flame alive, you know, like it was like a real life. Well, you referenced The Road, right? And like that's fiction, okay? Like keeping the light alive, like gotta keep the light alive. Like this guy kept the light alive in the Gulag for decades, you know? And like, like when you're a person, you know, like
right.
When you're a person, like he couldn't he wasn't in control of the sweep of history, you know. He wasn't. he's a grain of sand in the ground in the wheels of history, right? And what? And he he did well with what he had, you know, and like what more could any of us hope to do than to do well with what's God has given us in our sphere of influence, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, raise your son as well as you can. Love your neighbors as well as you can. Like, I don't want to do it out of fear. If I'm going to prepare for an apocalypse, like, there's, like, the apocalypse choosing not to try to love God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength. And I tasted choosing not to try, and that is what terrifies me. That's what terrifies me.
I am telling myself the story of my life, stranger and song of fiction. We start with the joyful mysteries before the appearance of ether, trying to capture the elusive. The farm where the crippled horses heal, the woods where autumn is reversed, and the longing for bliss in the arms of some beloved from the past. I said, "Your daddy loves you." I said, "Your daddy loves you very much. He just doesn't want to live with us anymore."
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
canciones, el trío y el mariachi llenarán de mil perfumes la flor del Alcatraz. Miles de gente van hasta Guadalupe en procesión, miles de voces cantando el mismo son. Es un poema que en México a la orilla de un palmar, los arbolitos juntitos nacerán. México, viva mi rancho y mi ciudad, que viva México, viva mi gente en libertad, que viva México, viva mi rancho y mi ciudad, que viva México. Sinaloa y Potosí, Hidalgo, Puebla, Jalisco y Nayarit. Y si en Durango en la noche te pica un alacrán, una chamaca te besa en Culiacán. Cuando millones de mariposas van a Michoacán, de mil pireguas se llena sin Susán. Aquí el mixteca, nostalgia de Sonora, los mexicanos no deben olvidar. Que viva México, viva mi rancho y mi ciudad. Que viva México, viva mi gente en libertad. Corridos y rancheras se nos van por esa muda cuando regresará. Mucho el tarasco, mixteco, tarahumara y otomí, las tradiciones deben sobrevivir. Noche de muertos del árbol de la vida partirá blanca paloma hacia la eternidad. Por tantas cosas que van haciendo el sueño realidad, México lindo, no te podré olvidar. Que viva México, viva mi rancho y mi ciudad. Que viva México, viva mi gente en libertad. Que viva México, viva mi rancho y mi ciudad. Que viva México, viva mi gente en libertad.
puerta jalando estaba solo, como un perro. Y para colmo mis vecinos no dejaban de poner esa rola de Versus que dice como la mitad soto narco, el presidente, guau 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 guau. Así que agarré mi chamarre, me fui el cobadonga. Casi siempre hay una banda y desarmé alguna onda. Todos en las mesas jugaban dominó. Yo prefería estar con mis cuates para armar algo punk. Era una cruzada sagrada para encontrar reventón.
Agárrate una nave para reventar. La fiesta es en la Roma o es en Coyoacán. Agárrate una nave para reventar. La fiesta es en Portales o es en Coyoacán.
Y ahí vamos todos como idiotas, buscando la calle Progreso, esquina con Reforma. Siempre se me olvida que ese tipo de fiestas nunca tienen chupe ni coca de dieta. De vuelta al coche, por la manzana, buscando un Oxxo, y es de mañana. Ya ni te cuento en la mañana, me mudó de velón. Nos hubiéramos quedado jugando dominó.
Agárrate una nave para reventar. La fiesta es en la Roma o es en Coyoacán.
Yo estoy muy viejo para esos trotes, ya no me late y no son azotes. Tal vez estoy perdiendo condición.
Nine, 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 para.
¿Qué pachuca, Holguerio?
Creo que lo que dices no es nada correcto.
¿Debo de seguir en el reventón?
Debes de buscar a la batida adecuada. Comete unos tacos de canasta a mi cuadra y seguir desde por ocho hasta la madrugada.
Agárrate una nave para reventar. La fiesta es en la Roma o es en Coyoacán. Agárrate una nave para reventar. La fiesta es en la Roma o es en Coyoacán. Agárrate una nave para reventar. La fiesta es en la Roma o es en Coyoacán. Agárrate una nave para reventar. La fiesta es en la Roma o es en Coyoacán. Agárrate una nave para reventar. La fiesta es en la Roma o es en Coyoacán. Agárrate una nave para reventar. La fiesta es en la Roma o es en Coyoacán.
Ingratos ojos míos no me dejan en paz. Cada vez que te miro te quiero más y más. Con esos ojos míos no sé qué voy a hacer. Si tú no me comprendes me vas a enloquecer. Y no me mates, papacito, no más déjate querer. Ellos tienen la culpa de mi grande ilusión. Sin verte te recuerdo con todo el corazón. Cuando te estoy mirando de amor sufro por ti. Ingratos ojos míos, ¿por qué serán así? Llorar de pena los voy a condenar, porque por culpa de ellos no te podré olvidar. Cuando te estoy mirando de amor sufro por ti. Ingratos ojos míos, ¿por qué serán así?
Llegar jamás vos confundís mi vida más y más.
Vamos
hacia otro destino a encontrar algún lugar en el camino. Hora de huir, de salir de aquí, de encontrar algún lugar donde morir. Y seguir soñando hasta que el sueño sea real. Seguir soñando hacia otro destino.
Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
The army sent my daddy home with shrapnel in his hands. Uncle got him working at the plant. He said he felt like he was back behind a prison wall. Ma said it was a shame he came home at all. Left us rosaries and magazines and cards. She prayed as I played in the yard. Daddy left his work boots in the dumpster up the street. The foreman said, take all the time you need. He took up carving figures with a rusty pocket knife. His broken hand brought the wood to life. He whispered and he hung while he whittled with his thumbs and told me fairy tales that he made up. He talked about the desert and a soldier on a quest, and he twitched as he described the sun's relentlessness. He pulled the window curtains down and next took the blinds. I wonder if he thought the sun might need his help to shine. Thank you.
take a look out high above the clinic steps. 50 stars and countless cast-off cigarettes. Mama left the bus fare on the counter with a key. I let Daddy have the window seat. At night he'd often pace, and then he'd curl up on the floor. He had a favorite spot near the door. One morning Mama kicked him as she hurried off to work. He groaned, but he didn't say a word. And when he awoke, he grabbed his coat and reached out for my hand. Then he vanished like an etching on the sand. Ma told me that she always knew he'd end up on the street. She said it even when the tears rolled down my cheeks. Mama got new curtains and a man to share her bed. Time for me to move along, she said. Uncle bought my ticket and a shiny pocket knife, and I'm leaving for the desert with a shadow at my side.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
You've tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs anthology from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon from WRCT, and I'm joined here on a park bench on a beautiful summer day by Carnegie Mellon University professor Brian Junker. Brian, what department are you in?
Hi, Richard. It's good to be here. I'm in the Department of Statistics and Data Science.
Okay. I'm so old that when I went to college, there was no computer science major. There was applied math. How long has statistics always had its own departments?
No, statistics used to be a part of the math department, and that's generally historically how statistics departments get started. Eventually, the mathematicians and the statisticians realize they can't talk to each other very well, and so statistics breaks off and forms its own department. That happened in the late 60s or the 70s at Carnegie Mellon.
Okay, well, we're not here to talk about office politics. We're here to talk about lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Oh man, you really like to offend statisticians when you interview them, don't you?
Well, you know, ever since I was a kid, you know, like reading Mad Magazine and stuff, I kind of remember there was one joke book about chocolate. And one of the points was how much protein was in chocolate. And here was the stat about this enormous amount of protein. But then there was an asterisk noting the gargantuan amount of chocolate you'd have to eat. I think that's everybody's sort of the layperson's appreciation of statistics. It's like people tell their own stories, making things up with the numbers.
Right, absolutely true. And in fact, for the last, 30, 40 years, there's been a strong movement toward increasing numeracy for the layperson, just like literacy was a big issue that led to the formation of public schools and things like that. But I will say that, you know, once you become a little bit numerate, that is, once you sort of become a little bit less afraid of the numbers and can interpret them, what you realize is that all those lies and damn lies are equally tellable with numbers as with language. Open the newspaper. Look at what's in the newspaper that's written in English. Listen to your favorite news channel that you hate, and listen to what they have to say. with no numbers at all, they're equally capable of lying. So it's just learning another language, like learning French or German or Chinese.
People can do so many different things with the numbers. Like one of the quotes you had up on your website from C.H. Combs was, we buy information with assumptions. And those assumptions show up in the numbers that we have, that we hear in the news.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I actually specifically went and refound that quote myself because I wanted to make sure to bring it up during our talk today. It's one of my favorite aphorisms. It really is. Assumptions are really important. I mean, what you can collect from the real world, what you collect is facts. You collect data without any context or interpretation. And the way you convert that data into information, first of all, is by organizing it. And organizing it requires assumptions. You have to sort of know what you're looking for when you're organizing the data. And then to actually use that information in some useful way, you typically are trying to make a prediction about the future. And the only way to do that is to make assumptions about how the data was generated and how it'll happen in the future. So, yeah, you have to have raw information, you have to have assumptions, you combine them, and that's how you get knowledge and prediction. And if you have the wrong assumptions, or assumptions that don't fit very well, you make terrible inferences and terrible predictions about what's going to happen in the future.
That's one of the things that, as a statistician, you help your students understand?
Absolutely. I think my specialty and the specialty of a lot of statisticians is building statistical models, which are really mathematical formulations of the assumptions that you need to understand how the data arose or how to make predictions from the data. And that's what we teach. That's a part of what we teach in the Department of Statistics and Data Science, is how to build those models and how to use those models, how to use those assumptions. Whether you're trying to select the best football player to recruit for the Steelers, or you're trying to predict the efficacy of COVID vaccines or whatever, it's all a combination of facts and models.
Or people my age, if you're trying to make your retirement savings last.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that also is a matter of prediction. You're making assumptions about what's going to happen in the economy. Should I take my investments out of high yield, high risk products and put them in something safe, or will I go with the assumption that the economy is going to grow for a while first?
We're talking with Brian Junker from the Carnegie Mellon Department of Statistics and Data Science. And one of the things that has led me to come talk to you, Brian, is just seeing how much numbers are part of the story that Republicans and Democrats and different countries, and it's all part of the story that they're trying to sell to the consumer, to the reader of the news, the watcher of the TV.
Well, absolutely. And I think, historically, and here's a little etymology lesson, if you will. The word statistics is derived from the word state. And really, statistics began as a way of organizing data so that governments could better govern, at least better in the view of the people who were governing. So some of the earliest statistics had to do with understanding how much farmland there was, or how much crops were grown, so that governments would know how much to tax. That has grown so that now we use statistics in the form of summarized data to understand how welfare should be distributed, how Congress people should be distributed across the states, and so forth. So that kind of information, again, whether it's used with good intention or with bad, is a central part of government.
Using information for good or bad, you're making it sound like it's a double-edged sword that anybody can use for any purpose.
Well, that's pretty much true. I mean, tools are tools, and the goodness or the badness of tools depends on how you use them. You can use a hammer to build a house, or you can use a hammer to hurt someone. It's a hammer either way, and you try to use the hammer for good instead of for bad.
How do educational institutions like Carnegie Mellon, how do they use statistics?
You mean the institution itself,
Yes.
So there is an Office of Institutional Research at Carnegie Mellon. It has a slightly fancier name than that, but that's basically the idea.
As at many universities. Yeah.
Yeah. Most universities have that, and they are collecting data about students and about departments and about the functioning of the university, sometimes directly by looking at records that the university is keeping anyway, and sometimes by doing surveys to find out what students are happy with or what they're worried about. Those kinds of surveys happen essentially every year. There's a survey that's given to all incoming freshmen, and then another survey that happens, I believe, at the end of the first year. And then mostly at the department level, there are exit surveys for students who are graduating.
What kind of data are they looking for?
Well, with those surveys, they're looking mostly for example, what students may know or think they know when they come to Carnegie Mellon as freshmen. And then the later surveys often are addressed to questions about what the students have learned while they're at Carnegie Mellon. There may also be questions about, things that are not so much knowledge related, but are related to the kinds of experiences students have had, whether they feel comfortable at the university, whether they feel like they can go to professors to talk about things or other students to talk about things. All those kinds of things affect not only the knowledge that's imparted at Carnegie Mellon, but also the atmosphere of Carnegie Mellon. And like most universities, Carnegie Mellon is interested in optimizing both of those things.
Institutional research and data collection. Obviously, governments do a lot of that, and then it gets repeated in the news media. You see people freaking out about COVID-19 vaccines because of this or that factual tidbit that comes out. How does taking a measured statistical approach help someone understand what's going on in a situation like dealing with whether or not to be vaccinated or those kinds of things?
Well, I think to some extent this is another area in which that idea of numeracy becomes really important. And it's not so much being familiar with numbers, because after all, we all know about the 10 digits and we know how they combine to form other numbers. But it's really understanding something about how experiments are designed and conducted to understand how effective a vaccine is, or to understand what the side effects of a vaccine might be. And I think with something like the COVID vaccine, what's important to understand is, among other things, is that although the process was accelerated relative to other vaccines, these vaccines that have been so effective, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine and several others, are built on more than a decade of research. And they went through the same rigorous process of experimental evaluation that every other vaccine that is approved by the U.S. government goes through. And understanding that process, even a little bit, is really helpful in deciding whether you're going to do the vaccine yourself.
You used again that term numeracy, which I think of in terms of understanding how the numbers are used. And one of the things that I know some people are freaking out and say, oh, this vaccine is only listed at 75% effective or 92% effective, but they don't go back and look to see what that means. That means even if someone gets a mild case, it counts as a strike against the vaccine. But in general, if you look overall, it's been reducing the virulence of the outbreak. But people just hear that number and it's not 100.
Right. Well, there are no 100s in the world. And that's the other thing that statistics is really helpful in helping people understand, is that very, very few things in this world are completely certain. And one of the things that statisticians do is develop methods for deciding how certain or uncertain a result or a fact is. And the good thing about the vaccines for COVID, for example, is that by and large, they're really highly effective. A number like 92% is an amazing number for a vaccine, especially when what we're considering is the failures, as you say, the breakthrough infections are likely to be greatly ameliorated by the vaccine, by the antibodies that your body builds up because of the vaccine.
We're talking with Brian Junker from Carnegie Mellon's Department of Statistics and Data Science, and as you're talking about this and how people can manipulate numbers a little bit to sort of tell their own story, I think of economics and all the economic models that get built, but they're all built on assumptions.
They certainly are. I mean, I think the thing that economics adds to statistics is thinking more carefully, or at least making thoughtful assumptions about what the value of different outcomes is. And so, we might be thinking about something like opening up an institution for public use that's been closed for over a year because of COVID. And